WGN.
Good evening. Welcome, everybody. It's Karen Conti here for 2 hours of talk. We've got legal issues. We've got non-legal issues. Despite the fact that Roger Badish is still talking about flurries, I'm a little bit encouraged, Roger, because yes. I hear baseball scores.
Yes.
I hear baseball scores. I see that it's still a little bit light out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're heading in the right direction.
It's only sweater weather now, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Not bad. And remember, it's 7 o'clock. It's not
That's
6 o'clock.
Right.
Make sure you go to the bedside and turn that alarm clock up, because if you forget, you're going to be late for work tomorrow. We've got a great show. We're going to be talking about judges. We're going to be getting into the head of a judge. How does a judge make a decision? Why should we get up to speed on judicial elections? How can we know if judges are good? Why should we care? We'll be talking to Judge Travis Richardson. Then we'll be talking about an issue relating to women. It's Women's History Month, and the Chicago Bar Association is sponsoring some segments here that that we are going to be talking about female issues, women's issues. And one that's near and dear to my heart is domestic violence. And Judge Patrice Ball-Reed presides in one of the courts at 55555 West Harrison, and she's going to be talking about domestic violence, orders of protection, stalking, teen violence, all of these things that happen in front of her in the courthouse, and she's a fabulous judge, and we'll be talking to her. We'll also be taking your legal questions starting at 8 o'clock. As you know, I'm a practicing lawyer. I can answer questions and direct you in the right place for all types of issues. I'll do my very best to steer you in the right direction, and I'll give out that number now so you can program it into your phone, and at 8 o'clock, I'll be taking those calls. That number is 312-981-7200. Text to that same number, 312-981-7200. Let's just talk about a few things I saw on the internet this week. First of all, there was a really interesting study that was done, a new comprehensive study that found that people would rather have fake news and false rumors than true news. This was, I was astounded. First, I thought it was fake news. So I read into it, and it was very comprehensive study. It was done over a long period of time with a lot of different people. And the idea is that fake news and rumors reach more people, penetrate deeper into the social network, and are spread faster than accurate news stories. This is astounding. I don't know. Remember, was it I think Mark Twain has attributed this quote, but I'm not sure if he said it, but the idea goes, a lie will go around the world while the truth is pulling its boots on. And this seems to confirm that. Very, very interesting. It says that a false story reaches people 6 times faster in all areas of topics, business, war, terrorism, science, entertainment. But the most extreme topic for this, for fake news being more permeated into the fiber of people, is in the area of politics, which is even more astounding and, frankly, a little bit alarming and disturbing. Interesting that falsehoods are 70% more likely to get retweeted than accurate news in the area of politics. And I guess you can understand that something that's fake news is probably novel. It's probably something you've never heard before. It's something somebody made up. And it also evokes emotion. It's usually something that evokes something like disgust or shock or horror, as opposed to real news, which at least you can understand logically why something would happen. So my opinion, we have a country that's based upon our electorate knowing the real truth about issues and about people and about what goes on. And it is really astounding that people would rather hear false things and then make their decisions based on falsities rather than on truthful things. So I don't know what we do to change that, but I think that's something we need to think about every day when we're looking at the internet. Interesting, too, I saw another study that was done this week. It was about stay-at-home parents. And as many of you may know, I practice, you know, in the area of family law for a good part of my practice. And so I deal with a lot of women and men who choose to be stay-at-home parents and who may have to go back to work at some point in their careers. This was a very sad study for stay-at-home parents. It said that parents who have stayed at home for any length of time who are looking to reenter the workplace are half as likely to receive callbacks than unemployed parents. They are viewed, according to this comprehensive study, as being less reliable, less deserving of a job, and less committed to a profession. So that people who stay at home are going to be viewed there. The study done by MIT, they actually sent out bogus resumes where they left gaps in the resume saying that they were a stay-at-home parent. And these are the results that they get. Interestingly, this study is even worse when it comes to fathers that stay at home. A father that stays at home is going to be viewed even more harshly and strongly that they are lacking in commitment to a job or to a profession. So it's very interesting because when I see people get divorced, the laws are very not super favorable to people staying out of the workforce. If you've been out of the workforce and you have children and you want to stay at home, obviously that's a great thing to do. It's a very dedicated thing to do. It's much harder than working a real job, I'll tell you that. But at some point, the judge could say, yeah, you stayed at home, but I'm going to give you 2 or 3 years. You're going to get your resume out. Maybe I'll give you some time to take some classes or coursework, but you're going to be going back to work. Otherwise, you're not going to be getting any more support from your spouse. So I see this all the time, and I'm not sure what advice I can give based upon that, other than I think it's very important that if you choose to be a stay-at-home parent, that you keep your foot in the door and you keep your contacts, and maybe you work a little bit part-time, or maybe you work a little bit at home if you can manage it, because going back to work is hard, especially as you get older, and the judges are not super concerned with making sure that people are okay in that regard. And on a lighter note, I guess, are you in an inebriated state? Jerry's looking at me. My husband's looking at me. This week, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, came out with a list of the states with the most alcoholic consumption. I don't know why I find this very interesting, but the highest is in the Midwest. The highest alcohol consumption is in the Midwest. I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought maybe the colder climates. It gets lower in the South. And there is a direct correlation between level of income and the amount that people drink, meaning if you make more money, you drink more, according to this survey. So we have number one, North Dakota, the most inebriated state. 24% of all people reported excessive drinking in that state. Interesting. I don't know that I'll drive there. Not that I have any reason to go to North Dakota, but second is Wisconsin. Third is Alaska. I sort of figured Alaska. It's dark a lot, and I understand that that there are a lot of bars and a lot of watering holes there, so to speak. Number four is Montana, and number five, the land of liquor. I mean, the land of Lincoln, Illinois. Then Minnesota, Iowa, Hawaii. Hawaii is up there. I think maybe it's all you need is one Mai Tai, really, right? And then Nebraska, and then Michigan. So those are the most inebriated states. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we will be talking to Judge Travis Richardson about being a judge and getting into the mind of our judges. This is Karen Conti, and you're listening to WGN. This is Karen Conti. We're talking about elections. And elections are coming up on March 20th. And I hear all the time, I don't know about judges and I don't care. Some people care. Some people want to know. And we're going to be talking about why you should care. We are going to be talking about how you can know who you're voting for judge, because it's a very important matter. And with us tonight in studio is Judge Travis Richardson, who is running for judge on March 20th and is a judge sitting on the bench. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Nice to see you. So tell our listeners why it matters who our judges are.
It matters because the judges and the judicial branch is the, I guess, the last line of for defense and justice in our society. Whenever there's a conflict that cannot be resolved between either entities or individuals or even the other branches of government, they come to the judicial branch to resolve those differences for them. And it's extremely important that people take the time to vote for the judges and investigate who you're voting for, because it's very unlikely that you're ever going to have a sit-down one-on-one perhaps with the current governor, Rauner, or any of the potential governors who are running on the Democratic ticket right now. But the chances that you're going to have some interaction, or someone in your family is going to have some interaction with the court system or with the judge, is not so remote. In fact, it's very likely, whether it's a traffic ticket, whether you've been the victim of a crime, whether you've been charged with one, whether you're going through a foreclosure, whether you're suing someone or being sued, whether you're going through probate, there are so many ways you could wind up being in front of a judge. So it's very important that you do your investigation and select competent, experienced, compassionate judges who can treat people with dignity and respect.
Amen. And I hear all the time, Judge, that people complain, particularly in the divorce realm. My child has to go live with my ex this many days, and now he has to be here, and I don't get enough child support, and the judge decided where he went to school, and I had no say in it, and the judge didn't know what he was doing. You hear all those things, but I say to myself, those decisions, what more important decisions are there than those that are close to you? Your livelihood, your children, the things that belong to you, your business relationships, your freedom, your very freedom, and whether you think you're ever going to be charged with a crime, you just don't know. It may be your son, or it may be an uncle, but there are people that are touched by the legal system every single day, and having good judges is really important.
Yeah, certainly, because, see, a judge can take many things away from you and can give you many things. A judge can take your money. A judge can take your home. A judge can take your freedom. A judge can take your property. A judge can take your children. So it's very important, once again, that people take the opportunity to learn who they are voting for and not just vote based on appearances or the way a name sounds, or if they think a name is a certain particular ethnicity or not. They need to do their homework so that they do not regret having voted for someone who they wind up in front of, and then they realize just how important it was to have put some more thought into that decision.
Let's talk about being a judge. You've been a judge for a little over a year, I believe.
Yes, I was sworn in on Valentine's Day of last year.
Nice. And have you enjoyed being a judge?
It is singularly the best job I've ever had.
And what makes a good judge? I mean, every day you sit and you've done a few different things as a judge, and I believe now you sit in criminal court and you deal with misdemeanors and some felony hearings and things like that. What goes through your head when each person comes up before you? What are you trying to do, and how are you thinking?
Well, I'm paying attention to the facts of the case. It is very easy as a human being to behave normatively rather than objectively. I believe that we're all, you know, raised in different environments and bring all of those experiences with us to the bench. But the most important thing is to be a listener. The judge should not be the one doing the most talking in the courtroom, I believe. I believe the judge should be the one doing the most listening. And if you listen to the facts and you take the proper notes and you use your experience with the law, and as a former practitioner, you can arrive at the right and proper decision, in looking at these cases in front of me. So that's what I do. I look at the facts, I consider the law, but I also take into account the disposition of the witnesses. I look at not the appearance, but their reaction to the questions and how readily they answer them, as opposed to stalling or hemming and hawing and beating around the bush. These are all the things that we look at because it bears on the witness's credibility.
Now, when the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court justices are being selected, there's a lot of talk about the backgrounds of the judges. And President Obama said something during one of his terms about, and it was refreshing, because he said, of course, judges can't come to the bench with no prejudice. Of course they come with baggage. Of course they come, as you said, from a history, whether they come from poverty or they come from affluence, whether they come as a woman, you have a whole different perspective having grown up as a woman and gone to law school. Your age has everything to do with how you view the world. And yes, we have our prejudices, but we are also bound by the rule of law, meaning precedent. Can you just describe briefly? You can't just decide things based on how you think things should go, right?
No, you can't, because that would lead to, I believe, chaos. That's why we have the rule of law. Precedent is the body of cases that a judge may look to for guidance on how to decide a case that is currently in front of him or her. And that gives you the some idea of the reasoning that goes into the decision-making process on why you're going to be deciding a case one way or the other. For example, if there's a matter before the court, such as what is an obstructed windshield, and someone had an item hanging from perhaps a rear view mirror, and the judge was not sure that this particular item would count as a quote unquote obstruction. Well, it's very easy to take a break or to give the matter another date for consideration and do the research and find out what our brethren and sistren on the appellate court and in some cases the Supreme Court of Illinois have said about obstructions of windshields. And then once you do that research and you have some kind of idea of what an obstruction actually is, then you have a basis and a framework for making your decision.
And you're not reinventing the wheel. And,
exactly.
And like as you said, it could be very chaotic if each judge has his or her own opinion on what that constitutes. We were watching and talking about the Nassar sentencing, and this was the case of the gymnast who had been sexually abusing girls for many years, and the girls were allowed to come and give their victim impact statements, and it was very emotional. And we kind of knew what the outcome was going to be, and this was really a forum really for the women. But when you sentence someone to some sort of punishment, what are you thinking about? What are the criteria and what are your concerns?
Well, we have guidelines. They are not the strict guidelines that the federal court heretofore had to follow, which led to many injustices, according to many of our policymakers and actually many judges and practitioners, where you would have someone who was a first-time offender, but because of the strict guidelines that they used to have in federal court, that person wound up being punished at a level that probably was not commensurate with the offense. So what I think about is what level of offense it is, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. I take into account all those things that the sentencing guidelines state that we should, such as their background, whether or not a weapon was used, what kind of weapon was used, whether the harm is permanent, whether or not there has been any show of contrition by the defendant, and all those things. And I take into account also whether or not this person is going to continue to be a danger to the community, or if there's something redeeming about him or her such that they should be shown the requisite compassion, because at some point, unless it is the highest of offenses, they're going to be returning to their community.
That's a major concern for you, because the prisons are very crowded and there's only a certain amount of time that you can sentence someone to, and certainly you don't want a bad dog going in there and being tortured for a year and coming out a worse dog. I have to go now, but I want to tell everybody to go to, there's a website called voteforjudges.org, and the bar associations, all the different bar associations, the different ethnic bar associations, women's bar association, they all do evaluations of the judges, which are very thorough, and they look up the records and they see how experienced the judges are and they interview the judges. I know Judge Richardson, you've been through those rigorous interviews, and print that out and bring it to the polling place. You're allowed to bring it in and vote intelligently for judges. And if you're going to vote intelligently, you should vote for Travis Richardson for judge on March 20th.
Yes, I'm running in the second sub-circuit, which is on the far south side of the city, starting at 83rd Street, going out to 183rd Street, with I-94 on the east and Pulaski on the west. And I'm happy to say that I've been found either highly qualified or otherwise recommended by every single Bar Association.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us on WGN. It's Karen Conti. You're listening to WGN. Every 9 minutes, a woman in this country is beaten. One in four women will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. Three women and one man each day is murdered in the United States by a significant other. And one out of three teens have reported being hit, pushed, or slapped by a boyfriend or girlfriend. Chicago gets 200,000 domestic violence calls each year, and there are 12,000 active orders of protection in the Chicago area. With us to talk about this very pervasive problem here and all over the United States is a judge who sits in that courtroom, in those courtrooms, Judge Patrice Ball Reed. Welcome to the show, Judge.
Thank you. Good. Glad to be here.
Good to see you. You sit in a courthouse on Harrison, and it's this big, massive courthouse, fairly new in build, and all you hear there is domestic violence. Does that still continue to shock you that we have such a pervasive problem?
Not really, because it happens so often, and many people don't talk about it, but when they do talk about it, they need the services, they need the protection, and so we need to have that kind of system in place to help them.
Now, I guess, you know, the Me Too issue has to do with mostly workplace issues, harassment, but when it crosses over into violence, then we have something different, and that is what your courtroom deals with. Is it helpful for you to try to have some psychological understanding of not only the victims who are subject to this abuse, but also the perpetrators and how they have come to be people who are abusive?
Well, in the building at Harrison, it's actually civil and criminal, and I do civil. That means you want someone to stay away from you. And as much as I would like, I don't have the resources to really get the other person some help. The bottom line is someone wants them to stay away from them. Many of them should pursue some criminal issues, but they don't, because they just want them to stay away. They don't want to necessarily go to jail, but if they go to criminal, they can have criminal liability.
So what is your typical case of an order of protection? Somebody comes in and they want an order of protection. What are the general allegations? I know everything's different, but
when they come over to Harrison, they go and they have to fill out a lot of paperwork. And the reality is that when they're coming in, they're representing themselves. So they have to realize they're going to have to prove their case to the judge to even get the emergency order, because they're coming there ex parte, meaning they're coming there by themselves. The other side is not there. So they're going to fill out the paperwork, and then when they come to talk to the judge, they're going to have to prove that they were harmed in some fashion or would be harmed in some fashion. So they have to explain all the conduct that occurred to cause them to come to court.
So what's a typical case? Let's take one where there's actual physical violence.
A woman came in at one point, and she had been in a car with the respondent, and he had a hammer, and he was trying to hit her in the knees with the hammer, and she got out of the car, and he chased her down the street. For whatever reason, she was able to get away, and she came to request order protection, and when she was there, I was thinking to myself, why aren't you going to the criminal route? Get the police report. Go through that process. And she explained she just wanted them to stay away. She didn't necessarily want to go to jail. She just wanted them to stay away.
And when I think people have an idea that if it's he says, she says, you lose. But that's not the case, because most domestic violence, or much of domestic violence, is something that happens in private.
Correct. When they come in, they're going to be by themselves, so they're going to get an order, emergency order, in most instances. When the other side comes in after they're served, then it's a matter of hearing both sides, because sometimes it's not true. Sometimes they've come in because they want leverage in a divorce case. Sometimes they've come in just to get the person to understand, I'm tired of what you're doing to me, but they initially do get an emergency order in most instances.
So the procedure is they fill out the paperwork, they come in by themselves, they are sworn in front of you.
Correct.
You listen to their case, you listen to the facts, you listen to the harm. You generally will enter an order of protection, generally, not always. And then 10 days later or so, the person is served, and now they have to come to court and testify, and then you make a decision about whether there will be a long-term order of protection. When you are judging credibility, and we talked to Judge Richardson a little bit about this, but how do you make a determination as to whether someone is telling the truth, and what kinds of evidence is helpful to you?
Well, the person being able to explain what happened, it's what should have been an emergency, meaning maybe 3 days ago something occurred. Sometimes persons are just angry, and so they've come in. Sometimes they are very afraid, but it just depends on what they say to me. But they have to tell me something that says there's going to be some harm and that they are really afraid, because sometimes they're not afraid. They just want them to stay away, but they've come to court to request this, as opposed to talking to the person and say, just stay away from me, because the respondents generally don't accept what they're saying. Because some guys have come in and said, well, I wanted closure. They kept coming around, and she was saying, I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to be friends with you. I don't want to date you anymore. But he kept coming, and so that level of harassment is sometimes the case, as opposed to somebody really just punching somebody or physically harming them.
And there's not just, as you alluded to, not just physical harm here. We have, and as you know, Judge, I'm involved in family law, and I see a lot of cases where, and again, when I say female, it goes both ways.
Correct.
Believe me, I have seen it both ways. In fact, I just had a case that came before to my attention where the guy had been subjected for 17 years to such abuse, verbal abuse, over the years, that when he finally got out of the relationship, he could finally sleep. He finally could sleep through the night. His blood pressure went down. He didn't need his pills anymore. And he realized that he was in the midst of real domestic abuse, whether it was not physical, but it was certainly verbal. And so I see that effect on parties. And your cases can handle that too, is right?
Correct.
Okay. So it doesn't have to be physical. It can just be financial abuse, which is, can you explain to our listeners what financial abuse is?
Well, that mostly happens with the elderly. I was duly assigned to the elder abuse. Well, it's called elder remedies and not called elder abuse, and domestic violence, and people who have children or grandchildren who have come to their homes and taking their money or taking them someplace to get money from them, and harming them in those kind of ways. So there can be financial abuse.
I've also seen where I'll just say men have no access to the bank account. Here's $100 for the month, and you're going to, you can either get gas or you can get food, one or the other. And so there's a lot of control issues when it comes to money, and money is control. So I do see a lot of that as well, which can be very emotionally harmful. We are talking about domestic violence with Judge Patrice Ball-Reed. If you have any questions for the judge, general questions about these types of issues, give us a call here at 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We are talking about domestic violence. If anyone has a question or comment, please call now, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. And remember, at the top of the hour, 8 o'clock, I will be taking your legal questions on any topic you might have, whether it's family law, small claims court, probate issues, general legal topics about the news that you might have for me. I'm happy to give it a stab and get you in the right direction. That number again is 312-981-7200. We're here with Judge Patrice Ball-Reed, who sits in the domestic violence court over on Harrison. Judge, thank you for joining us. Let's talk a little bit about the stalking. Stalking is something that's, I guess, a subset of abuse.
Actually, stalking is different. There's three different things that I can do in civil court. It's a civil no-contact stalking, and that's between persons who are generally not getting along. And then there's also civil, it's called sexual assault, civil no-contact order, and that's non-consensual sexual contact.
Okay. And that's also something that we deal with in civil orders of protection.
So the first one is you can basically order that you don't talk to her anymore. You can't text her. You can't phone her. You can't go to her house. You can't do that kind of stuff. Stay away from that person.
Yes, stay away from the person, yes.
And then the sexual part of that is, you know, you can't get close to that person. You can't have sex with her. You can't.
Right.
Okay. Now, let's talk about stalking, because that's a little bit different, but it's got some of the same elements. Tell me what stalking is.
Well, the stalking has grown into something that it shouldn't have become. When the legislation was first instituted, it was basically a woman who could not get an order of protection because she didn't have a relationship with the person. This person was trying to have a relationship with her, sending her gifts, calling on the phone, and doing those kinds of things, but she didn't know this person. And that's how the stalking kind of cases were created. Now, it should have been narrowed to that kind of conduct, but over the years, it's expanded, and people come in when they're having a fight with their neighbor. It's basically people coming in who don't have a connection either through marriage or blood. So any number of people come in for stalking orders.
And what's a typical case? Can you think of something that is a typical case that you see in the area of stalking?
Many times, unfortunately, it's women coming in when their significant other is dating someone else as well, and they're trying to get back at this person, so it's a way to harass them. You finally figure it out when both of them are in court, but when it's initially started, they have to have at least three instances where they were harmed by this person, and they have to testify to that, and then we try to serve the other side. If the other side is served, then they're both going to come in. But situations like that, it's really any number of times it can be just harassment.
I think there's a perception, Judge, that I hear women say, why would I get an order of protection? That's just going to make him more angry, and he's not going to follow it anyway. If he goes outside the bounds of decency and calls me and calls me and calls me 600 times and I have it on my cell phone, what makes me think that an order of protection is going to help the situation? Do you see a lot of people think that way?
Well, the civil orders, what happens is if the person violates the civil order, there can be criminal liability. It can become a misdemeanor, so that it would raise the level of, I guess, rehabilitating them in terms of, okay, I understand it was just stay away. Now I may go to jail, so they may stop. If they escalate, they can have more jail time.
Okay. And do the police take orders of protection seriously, in your view?
I think they do, because someone could be harmed and they don't want that on their conscience. And so they do take them seriously. Many times they will just say to somebody, go to 555, even as opposed to doing a police report or doing anything to get the person arrested, they will have them come over to get an order.
And I mean, in my view, I think the domestic calls that police, I went on a police ride along a long time ago as part of the Chicago Bar Association program, so I got to ride along, and I saw a lot of things. I saw shooting, I saw gang problems, but the ones that were, to me, the police treated, they were more afraid of those calls were the domestic violence calls, because everyone was heated up. There were drugs and alcohol involved. There was yelling and screaming. There were people being thrown out of the house with their underwear on and being told they have to go walk home. And it was a very, you know, I'm giggling, but it really obviously wasn't funny to the people who were involved. But you see emotions running high. Is that your cold court?
Yes,
is,
I'm sure that's why the police send them to get an order, because sometimes by the time they get to the building, they've calmed down. And so what happens many times, it's an initial conflict, and they just want them away for a few minutes as opposed to 6 months. And so the police would send them to get an order and give them some time to think about what they really want. Because at the moment, of course, as you said, it's heated, and they really want the person away and don't want to talk to them and don't want to see them. But sometimes it's just the heat of the moment. Other situations, it's a prolonged situation where they definitely need to get an order, and they have to make that decision for themselves.
Do you see a lot of, and I'll say women, who get an order of protection and then basically violate it themselves, go right back with the boyfriend?
Yes, they do. They do that a lot. Because, like I said, it's the heat of the moment, and so they want to order. They're angry. They want them to stay away. And unfortunately, sometimes it really is a situation where they need the person in the household to help pay the rent.
I'm going to go to a texter who said, hello, Karen, I wanted to ask the judge about an abusive spouse with narcissistic personality disorder. I can ask for an order of protection, but when he comes in, he will be charming and deny everything. And that's an interesting question because you probably have read a lot about narcissistic personalities, and they have very similar traits, and one of them is that. They can be Dr. Jekyll. They can be angry and controlling, and then, in the right frame of mind, can be extremely manipulative and charming. Do you see some of that?
Well, that's the thing about it. When you're sitting there listening to both sides, you have to weigh who's more credible and who's not credible. And unfortunately, sometimes they know that they are lying, and so you can tell they're lying because they start looking away, they're not paying attention, they're not being direct, and so you can, most times you can tell when they're not telling the truth.
Another texter said, my elderly mother has dementia and I have power of attorney. The sisters are asking her for money. This is very confusing, and she gets obsessed with helping them. She has no money to spare. Is that the type of elder abuse you're talking about?
Or yes. That's the situation where you want these certain persons to stay away. Unfortunately, with situations like that, the siblings are in conflict with each other, and the parent is in the middle, and the parent may come in and say, oh, no, I'm okay.
Right.
I really don't have a problem. But the reality is they need some protection. So you weigh the situation when they're all there.
Yeah, and that's a hard one because you're right. The siblings, half of them could say, no, we're doing everything for her. And the other half could say, no, you're taking your money and going on vacation. One final issue is cyber stalking. Do you deal with that issue in your court?
That has not come up as much because it's not really a part of what we've been working on over in Harrison. It's become more a criminal situation, so I haven't seen it much in civil court.
Because it seems to me that that's really a big part of where I see things really getting exacerbated, because stalking someone is one thing, but if you're putting things on social media and going at somebody that way, that's just a whole other force.
Well, you can come into court and request that all that social media be destroyed or deleted, and if they violate it, then you come back in to get the enforcement. But that's as hard as it's going to get, really.
Thank you so much for joining us, Patrice Ball-Reed, who sits in the Domestic Violence Court. It was very nice to meet you and talk to you about this really important issue. Welcome back. It's Karen Conti, and this is the time where you can get some free legal advice. How's that? I've been practicing law for a long time, 30 years. I started when I was about 5, so that's my age. You can add that up yourself. And give us a call here. I am going to be answering legal questions that you might have in any area. I might not know exactly what the answer is, but I can talk a little bit around it. I can maybe help point you in the right direction. And let me give out that number, 312-981-7200. 981-7200, and you can text to that number. If for some reason you don't get through or you want to talk to me in private, which I can understand that, you can always give me a call at my office, which is 312-332-7800, and that's a confidential number, so if you want to leave a detailed message, that's wonderful. But better yet, send an email, because then you can tell me what county you live in, you can tell me when the incident happened, and what your problem is, and what you would like to do. That's the best way to contact me. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com. wgn@askkarenconti.com. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Dave. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the show. This is Karen. Hi.
Hi, Karen. I have a brother who, 3 years ago when my mother died, we were getting the house ready to be sold. He made off with her artwork, paintings, fine china, crystal, etc. He's keeping all of this stuff in storage and says he'll give it up, but every time we have a family dinner or every time he says he's going to, you know, turn it over, he always has an excuse, and it's pretty clear to me he's holding on to it. And my mother did not will anything, household items specifically, to anybody. So is there anything that I can do? Can I take him to court or make a case against him to turn over the stuff?
And forgive me if you mentioned this, but is it going through probate, or has everything been distributed? Is it in court?
Everything is over. The house was sold, and, you know, he just made off with all these household items.
Yes.
And keeping them in storage. And, you know, in the will, you know, nothing was made to any of us specifically.
Okay. So, well, how much would you say all of it is worth if you actually sold it on Craigslist or in an antique store or a consignment shop?
You know, I couldn't put a price tag on it, but I think some of the stuff is fairly pricey. You got some original oil paintings from local artists.
Okay. All right, and the reason I ask you this is because as most of my answers to most legal questions, there may be a right and a wrong, but there's also a practical side, and that is it worth it to hire a lawyer to bring a lawsuit and to spend the money that you would need to spend in order to get your stuff back? So generally speaking, yes, you could take him to court. And I don't know, you have other siblings that might sign on for the lawsuit. It would be a case of replevin, which is a legal word that means giving me my stuff back. And you list out what the stuff.
Replevin?
Replevin, just like it sounds, R-E-P-L-E-V-I-N. And you could file that lawsuit, and you could probably even do that in small claims court, I think.
Yeah.
I think you can do that. Maybe if you can send me an email, and I'll tell you definitively whether or not you can do that. And then you ask the court to have him give that stuff back. Couple things. You can do that yourself, although going to small claims court is supposed to be user-friendly, but it's not always to a lot of people, and it's time-consuming because you have to go to court, and you have to be there, and you have to wait, and you have to park, and it becomes a little bit of an issue for some people. Number two, don't be surprised, Dave, if your stuff disappears. Don't be surprised if he says, you know what, I didn't take all of that, and some of it will never turn up. And then you're stuck telling the judge that there was stuff there, and you can't really identify how much it is valued at because you don't have it in front of you. So, you know, hiring a lawyer to do this, I'm not sure that you want to do that unless you have the money and the stuff means so much to you and you think it's of such value that it would be worth it. But that's something you should probably sit down and talk to a lawyer about. And maybe by filing the lawsuit, Dave, maybe he just says, all right, game's over. I'm going to give the stuff back, and then you can divide it up and move on. So
would he have to pay lawyer's fees and court costs if he loses or if me and my sister, for instance, get some of the stuff back? Because he's not in the right here.
Yeah, generally speaking, the winner doesn't always get fees unless it's provided for in a statute or a contract. And I don't see any way for you to get your fees. Court costs, yes, but that would just be a filing fee of, say, $200 or $300 and the cost to serve by sheriff, maybe another $100 or so. So there's not a lot of pressure on him to do anything because attorney's fees usually are not recoverable by someone who brings a suit, unless I said, like...
Okay, now, about small claims court, is there like a limit on how much people are suing for in small claims court? Is that a court where people can do things on their own without an attorney?
Yeah, there is a limit, and I don't know the exact limit. It's changed a little bit over the years, but replevin is something that is not so much the money part of it's the give it back part of it. And that's why I have to find out the answer to your question. Can you bring a replevin case in small claims? But I'm going to put you on hold and I'm going to tell you to call me at the office at 312-332-7800. Better yet, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Let's go to Jan. Jan, welcome to WGN. This is Karen Conti.
Hi, it's a pleasure talking with you, and thank you so much for this service.
Jan, you've got such a great voice. You should be on this.
You should
be over here on the radio with me.
Oh, no. Karen Conti's on one side of the continuum, and Jan Baker is on the other. I mentioned my last name, but it's a pretty common name. Okay, thank you very much. It so happens we live in Tazewell County, and my son has never had a ticket, period, at all. Yay! He's gotten to age 24. He's pretty responsible. And he was in Sangamon County, 17 miles over the speed limit. It's a $120 fine. And he has a court date of March 29th. The officer said, oh, you don't have to go to court, and it's checked on the ticket. Just pay the fine. Now, we understand that that's going to be on his record, possibly, for a number of years. And then secondly, if he would go to court, his friends, this is, you know, how the guys get together and all, they, one of them had a ticket, and he said, oh, well, I just ended up, you know, taking an online course, and it was, you know, I paid the ticket, and then it wasn't put on my record. So, and then... Yes.
So there's a couple things.
And then, too, do we need to, does he need to consult with a lawyer and have the lawyer by his side when he's in the courtroom?
So first of all, you know, I don't know the answers to all these questions, but the 20 miles, if you're going 20 miles over the speed limit, that's reckless driving, or if you're going over 80, no matter what the speed limit is.
Well, he was okay.
Okay, so I'm just that's
17 over.
Okay, so that's just a fact, and that elevates the charge to reckless driving. If it doesn't say it on the ticket, it probably isn't. I would recommend I would recommend you're in probably in the Springfield area, right?
Right.
So
we're in Tazewell County, and he got the ticket in Sangamon County,
right, which is Springfield, right? Springfield area. Right?
Yes, right. Exactly. Oh,
so,
yes.
So you're gonna what I would do, and I've got referrals down there. I would get a traffic lawyer down there. I would have him make an appearance at that court appearance, and the lawyer down there is going to tell him what to do. Whether that's take a course. Again, the laws are different, and they're very different all over in different counties where you go. But you can probably have him plead to some kind of supervision so that it doesn't go on his record. And if he has a certain number of months free of any moving violations, then that gets off of his record. So he doesn't have that record. I would always do that, especially with a young person. Yeah. You don't know how that's going to show up somewhere, and someone might check your record. You know, these days people have the ability to find these things out when young people are looking for jobs. So that makes sense. You're going to pay some money for the lawyer. He's going to have to go down there, and I think it's going to be worth it, though, in the long run to get that done. The other thing down there is the judges all know all the lawyers. I've practiced law in those in that county. So you get somebody who's connected down there, and not to say that's going to win the day, but it's not going to hurt at all. So give me a call at the office. Give me a call at the office or email me, and I'm happy to give you that information. It's WGN@AskKarenConti.com. We still have time for questions all the way until the 9 o'clock hour. Give me a call, 312-981-7200, or text to that number. You're listening to WGN.
In 10 years, we're going to have 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers, 1 million lawyers. In 10 years, we're going to have 1 million lawyers. How much can the poor nation stand? Everybody now. In 10 years, we're going to have...
Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. I'm taking your calls, 312-981-7200. Let's get right to it. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show. Do you have a legal question? Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Karen.
Hi, Tom.
Your show is so entertaining. I have a child support issue.
Okay.
That's driving me crazy.
Okay.
Okay. When I worked at UPS, I took a huge pay cut, and my child support went up to $80,000.
So when you say your child support, that's your arrearage, which means what you owe.
I do believe so. Both of my children are now adults, and I'm wondering, am I liable for this? Because it seems like the meter just keeps clicking.
Okay, here's the problem with owing child support. First of all, it's never good to owe child support. But what happens is there is huge interest and penalties for not paying it. And so your children are emancipated. That's the word we use to mean that there's no child support accruing right now. But that money is it's multiplying, and it's going to be a lot more than $80,000 very shortly. So what you need to do is you need to rectify this. I would have to sit down and talk to you about the plan, but there should be a plan whereby you can pay it off. And perhaps what you do is you talk to your ex-spouse through a lawyer or by yourself and try to come up with an agreement of what you owe and how you're going to pay it back. The agreement has to be in writing and it has to be in court. So if you have an agreement with your ex and it doesn't get put into a court order, the judge doesn't have to recognize it. So you're going to probably need to retain a lawyer to get this going and to put it in the right place. Maybe you make some payments over time. Maybe you are able to reduce that amount in exchange for liquidating maybe an account or some sort of 401k so you can pay it off. But let me tell you, it's sort of like the IRS. You don't want to owe money in that realm, because if she takes you back to court, you're going to be hit with a big judgment, and that could impact you for a long period of time. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. It seems like I'm kind of screwed.
Okay, well, why don't you give me a call or email me, Tom, and I am going to see if I have a plan for you, and maybe there's some questions that I have for you that will change some of my advice to you. But give me a call at 312-332-7800 or WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Let's go to Alan. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hey, I've been recently named as the executor of a will. Can you go over my responsibilities and how closely will I be working with an attorney?
Okay, and I'm going to give you real general advice, and again, I don't practice in this area, and I don't have the will in front of me, but generally an executor's job is to gather all of the assets from the estate. Think of it as a big barrel, and so all of those assets might be bank accounts, they might be a house that needs to be sold, it might be a lawsuit that needs to be finished, whatever it is, all of those proceeds are to go into a barrel, and that is the estate, and that is your job. And then the next part of your job is to give all of the beneficiaries of the will what they're entitled to, whether that's money, whether that's personal property. And you are going to be managing the money. You're going to be managing the bank accounts. You're going to be making decisions about how things are distributed according to the will, which means you don't have a lot of leeway here, but you have to follow what the will tells you to do. And generally speaking, you will have a lawyer who will help you through this. Without knowing how large the estate is, approximately how many dollars are involved, would you say all assets, all in?
Oh, I'm going to guess around $500,000.
Okay. So there probably will be a lawyer involved, and that lawyer will help you through the process of going through court. Now, is there a trust or just a will? Do you know?
I haven't seen the complete documents, but I believe there is a trust involved.
Okay.
Would I work with her attorney?
Whose attorney?
My stepmother's attorney, when she passes. Do I work directly with him, or do I hire a second attorney?
You probably work, well, I need to know more. I need to know who the beneficiaries are. I need to know if there's a trust and a will, because if there's a trust that handles most of the assets, it may be that there's no reason for probate and no reason for a lawyer if you're able to gather and garner all of those assets and debts and do that yourself. You know, I need some more facts on it, and probably I would refer you to a probate lawyer. I've got some really good people who I work with who can answer these basic questions, and if you need them, they're always on call. So why don't you give me a call at the office or email me, WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Good luck.
All right.
Good luck, Alan. Take care. Let's see if we can take one more call here. Vince, welcome to the show. It's Karen Conti. Can you tell me your question quickly?
Yes, Karen. I pay child support for a decree that was in place for about the last 10 years. I recently had a change in job where I make about 20% less money than I did before. I have two questions. Number one, I heard that there's a 20% modification rule that you have to have at least 20% less to modify. Is that true?
Yes.
And the second question, if I modify it today, do I operate under the current child support calculation rules or the ones that were part of my decree 10 years ago?
Good question. The 20% rule is correct. So let's just say for the listeners out there, Vince, if you had a 5% reduction in your salary, that wouldn't be enough for you to warrant coming in and asking for a reduction in child support, just because the courts don't like people coming back in every 5 minutes adjusting their support. But if you're at the 20% level, then yes, you could come back in and ask for a reduction. And the new law will apply. There's been a new law in place for a while. It's a very interesting law, but I'm not sure how effective it is, in my opinion. What it does is it takes into account not just the payer's money, But it takes into account the income from both families, and they determine who's making money, on what percentage should those child expenses be paid, what are the actual expenses of raising a child, and then there's a calculation accordingly. It's very difficult for somebody to calculate that on their own. You really do need a lawyer or a judge to do that for you, but in most cases, and I don't say all of them, but most cases, the payor is going to pay less under this new statute. I find that it goes very light on paying child support and almost to the detriment of people who are caretaking children. So not only have you reached the 20%, not only are you going to be operating under the new statute, but you probably are going to have a substantial reduction. And you can give me a call at the office. I can even run the numbers for you if you're interested.
That's great, Karen. I really appreciate it. It's
okay.
Very helpful.
Good luck to you. Good luck to you. You're listening to Karen County. Cash, do I have more time or do we take a break? Okay. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be taking more legal questions. But we're also going to have a special guest who is one of the smartest kids in all of Chicago. His name is Jack Fetch, and he's one of the five students at Whitney Young who scored a perfect score on the ACT. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard, hoping to pass.
This week, it was announced that five juniors at the magnet school, Whitney Young, scored a perfect 36 on their ACT test. It's the first time that many scored perfect in one year at one school. Joining us to celebrate is one of the five Whitney Young students, Jack Fetch. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
This is fun. I'm so glad you're here. And I do want to mention the other four people who scored perfectly. It was Jake Garenrich, Sophie Young, Charles Nevins, and Dorothy Tarasol. Congratulations to all of you. To put this in perspective, my research says that only 0.1% or of the 2 million students who took the test received perfect score. So you're in a very small group.
Yeah, you can say that. But it's definitely something that was possible because of the fact that we go to a school with such a supportive administration and staff that this is possible. So I really wouldn't view it as some sort of outlier, because if you know the culture at Whitney Young and you know how supportive the teachers and administration is, it's just sort of... It wasn't as big as a surprise as it could have been.
It's a great place to go, huh?
I love it there. It's a great school. I've been given so many opportunities there that I wouldn't have been able to get somewhere else. And I'm going to be sad when I graduate in June of 2019.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. But let me ask you a sort of technical question. Do you think you scored a perfect score on the ACT because you knew more stuff like math and history and science and all those things? Or is it because you kind of knew how to study for it?
Oh, it purely came down to the format of the test. The thing about the ACT is that if everyone had an unlimited amount of time, I think 90-95% of people could get almost every math, reading, science, English question correct. The reason that the test is so hard is because of the fact that they make you answer 75 English questions in 45 minutes. They make you answer 60 math questions in 60 minutes. It's because it's the format of the test. So when I studied for the test, I started studying about a week and a half before the actual exam. I didn't learn any new grammatical concepts. I reviewed a couple, but I didn't, you know, learn any new math concepts. I didn't learn how to read a text differently. I didn't learn any new science concepts. I just became better at applying those concepts to the format of the test, which is basically just doing practice test after practice test in time conditions.
Now, having a perfect score, does that set you in a really good position to get into good colleges?
I don't want to deny that it definitely takes some pressure off the whole college application process.
Yes.
Junior year is always a stereotypically stressful year because you're trying to make sure that your test scores are where they need to be. But there's still so many other factors that come into play, what you do outside of school, the impact that you make on your school community, that I'm not going to place so much emphasis on one particular standardized
test.
And
your grades. And let me just say, your grades are pretty good, too. I think that you have a 4.0. You haven't had a B. When was the last time you had a B anywhere?
Probably a while back, beginning sometime maybe early elementary school.
And so, but if you weight your GPA, meaning you take these classes that are a little more difficult, so they're weighted differently, your GPA is around 5.2.
Yes, it is.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. So where do you think you might want to go to college? What are some of the places that you're looking at? And what are your criteria for picking a good college?
Well, I love Chicago for sure, but I definitely want to go for the experience of getting to know a different city.
That's a great idea.
Again.
Yeah.
And I'm really looking towards the East Coast. I'd love to go to school in Boston, Philadelphia, or Washington, D.C. Those are the free cities that I'm really looking at.
Is there
right
one
now.
Beginning with an H that might interest you?
No particular school at this point. I'm going out to Boston over spring break to look at some schools, but I don't want to place so much emphasis on a particular school. There's so many great schools out there, and I'm excited to see where the application process takes me.
Well, and it's nice to be in your position because it sounds to me that you have a really open door here to a lot of great opportunities. I know that parents do this. They get in their car with their kids or they take a flight and they map out the schools and they make plans to meet with administrators and they have programs where you can kind of mm-hmm. get acquainted with the school. Is that what's going on? Or how many schools are you going to see, do you think, when you go out there?
Just a couple schools in particular. I just sort of planned it out myself, looking online. All these schools nowadays have so many resources available online for you to plan your own visit that it makes it really easy.
Now, being at Whitney Young, you tell me you really love being there, but is there pressure? I mean, when you're in a position where you haven't ever gotten a B in high school, that has to put pressure on you. Is it something that you're doing, spending a lot of time on homework, or are you having some fun too?
There's definitely a lot of late nights, but I think the aspect of pressure at Whitney Young isn't to the point that it's unbearable. It's totally possible to involve yourself in a lot of extracurriculars and clubs at the school. We have over 100 clubs and activities at Whitney Young that you can get involved in, and everyone there, every single stellar student there is involved in so many activities. You don't want to let your course load overwhelm your life by any means.
It sounds like you've got sort of a grip on the balance there. I know you are very involved in politics. Can you tell our listeners what you're doing now with politics?
I became a finance intern with Chris Kennedy's campaign for governor back in last May, and I've really enjoyed the whole experience over the past year or so. It's just really been a great opportunity. I've learned so much about the political process as a whole, and it's been a great thing to be a part of.
So you're in the finance. So what is it that you actually do?
Fundraising, basically.
Okay. And do you have an interest long term in perhaps going into politics?
I would say that whether I go into political science or not, the internship has just been an invaluable experience, and I'd recommend that every teenager out there, no matter if you want to do something in engineering or English or mathematics, hold a political internship for one summer. Learn about how the political process works. Learn about how the campaigns operate. It really exposes you to a lot about our political system, and it's just a great opportunity for every young person to get involved in. You learn so much about the city, the county, the state. It's just invaluable.
And it's energizing. Totally valuable. It's got to be energizing to be around campaigns because it does take a lot of energy to get people excited and motivated, and I think that's what I'm hearing from you.
That's for sure. I would say that campaigns are definitely a very high-pressure environment, and Whitney Young has definitely prepared me for that.
Now, let's circle back to what may be your major in college. I mean, do you have an area of interest in particular or a career path that you're very motivated about?
I'm really interested in finance and economics, so seeing potentially where something with that might take me.
Okay, but you're also very articulate. Not that one excludes the other, but with the right brain, left brain, it sounds to me like you're just as good with your verbal skills as you are with your math skills.
I wouldn't say that for sure. But,
I would.
Thank you. It's flattering.
I'd like to see you on this side of the microphone, actually. So let me just ask you, guns in schools, what's your thought? And I understand there's going to be a walkout this week, and I'd like to hear your thoughts about it coming from a high school student.
So one thing that I love about the culture at Whitney Young is we we have an administration that's really supportive of student initiative, and we have a big group of students. A lot of my friends have expressed interest in organizing a school-wide walkout this Wednesday, sort of in the mid-late morning for 17 minutes for each one of the victims in Parkland. And it's really an opportunity for the school community to come together to bring light to such an issue. A couple of our teachers appeared on CBS Chicago a couple weeks back and had great remarks about their position on guns in schools.
I'm very happy to see young people getting involved, because that's not always been the case, and I find it interesting. Whatever way you look at this issue, whatever your politics are, it's nice to see young people care about our future and what's going on. And I'm hearing that from you loud and clear, which is nice.
Thank you.
Jack Fetch, I'm really happy to meet you, and I have a feeling I'm going to meet you again someday. And I want to congratulate you on being one of the five Whitney Young students who scored perfect on the ACT. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's been great to be on the air.
Have a great night.
You too.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law?
Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. This is our last chance here to get some legal questions answered. 312-981-7200. And don't forget, you can always call me at the office during the week or even tonight. Leave it on my answering machine. I guess I don't have an answering machine. I guess you call it voicemail. That just showed you my age there. 312-332-7800 is my office number. 332-7800. Or better yet, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. Let's go to David. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I called last week. I wanted to have a follow-up question, if I could. I don't know if you remember what I asked. I'll try to briefly review. You remember even about a friend of mine invested just over $75,000 with someone he never really met?
Yes.
He wrote up a contract.
Yes, I do remember that. And some years went by, and there was no business, and there was no money paid back, and there was kind of nothing coming from the other side. Crickets. So you asked me my opinion on what could this woman do.
Yeah, you do remember very well. Thank you. I'm just trying to ask, worst-case scenario, if the value here that he's lost is just over $75,000, can he, if he wins the judgment and tries to do what he can, I had a question there, what could he, if she didn't have any money, if she doesn't have any property, if she doesn't have a job, no bank account, even though he's got the judgment, would that include maybe two, three times what he lost plus his expenses? Or does he really just need to pucker hard and kiss that goodbye because it's just gone?
Well, here's the thing. There's no pain and suffering. There's no emotional distress. This would be a simple breach of contract case. Now, if you could prove fraud that this person who the contract was with, let's say, never intended to do this business and took this person's money and did it fraudulently. Now, fraud is hard to prove because you've got to prove it by clear and convincing evidence, which is a higher standard than a normal case. Then you can maybe get some punitive damages. But again, the judgment is only worth as much as you can collect it. So even if you get, generally speaking, a breach of contract, it's going to be the $75,000 that he paid her. You don't even get attorney's fees when you win, unless it's in the contract that there is a fee provision in there, which I'm sure there isn't. And you don't get punitive. You don't get emotional distress. You don't get anything except the money that you're out in a breach of contract case. So a lot of people don't understand that you can't punish someone for not paying a judgment. You can't really punish someone in any way other than trying to collect it. And I think that probably what you're going to want to do is, before you spend the money on an attorney, to have that private investigator or somebody go and do a run and see, does this person file bankruptcy? Does this person have a car or a home? Are there aliases? Are there other judgments against this person? Does the IRS become somebody who also is owed money? And all of these are red flags to lead you to the conclusion that maybe this person is not collectible. That means that it's not worth it going after that person because you've got other people standing in line. And David, my feeling is that when it comes to people who maybe are a little bit scam artist in nature, they don't really care about judgments against them. They're not like you and me. They don't care about their credit rating. And so it could be that this person is one of them, and you're not going to want to spend your time and money pursuing it. Okay.
How much could he expect to spend to start before he could maybe get a better sense of how he should go? Private investigator or just to consult with an attorney?
I think you should consult with an attorney first and get more of the facts. Let's look at the paperwork. Let's figure out a game plan. And maybe the game plan is the lawyer gets the private investigator. Maybe it's this person gets the private investigator. And then we reassess and decide what money would be best spent doing this kind of thing. And maybe the lawyer also writes a letter and says, listen, time's up. Give us the money back. If you don't, we're going to do the following and see if that maybe will prompt the person to at least come to the table and try to negotiate something with us. So
that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
Can I put an attachment to the email that I sent you with the contract? I thought that'd be handy if attachments are allowed.
Sure, that's perfect. And then I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thank you for a nice talking to you, and I hope I can give you some help. It's Karen Conti. You can email me at WGN@askkarenconti.com or 312-332-7800. Let's go to Tim. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, Karen. Quick question. I'm the executor of my dad's will, and my mom passed away many years ago, and everything was cut and dried, divided up between myself and my siblings. Everything was perfect until I stumbled on one annuity that he never listed myself or my siblings, just my late mother. Now, I filed all the paperwork with the company, and the last thing they're asking me for are testamentary papers.
So,
and I'm not quite sure what that is.
Well, what they are asking for are the trust and the will. Whatever papers your father executed to dispose of his property, because they're going to want to know if they're paying the money out to somebody. They want to make sure they're paying it out to the right person. They're going to want to see the paperwork that lists you as the executor so they know if they're sending a check to you that you're the right person. So you will send them a copy of the executed will, trust, whatever you have in that regard.
Okay, so okay. That doesn't really require me to go down to, county court and get paper stamped and file probate or anything.
No, you could call them and ask them, but I'm pretty sure what they want is to see that there is a legitimate will or trust that gives you the power and authority to do what you're doing. That's my best idea, but if you want to send me the paperwork, I'll take a look at it and tell you if there's anything else that you need to send. Okay?
Well, thank you.
All right.
I appreciate that.
Good luck. Good luck. It's WGN@askkarenconti.com. We have a, let's see, I'm just going to read it as I see it here. Hi, Karen. I was hit by a car at age 14, broke my hip and pelvis. Now at 51, I'm having hip replacement. Can my insurance company deny paying me health care costs since this is a result of the accident? No, there's no reason why an insurance policy wouldn't cover something because it was a result of an accident that you had so many years ago. Health insurance is by contract, they insure you for any medical issues that you may have. Just so you know, let's just say that this is really not relevant to the question, but just so you know, I have health insurance. I walk out in Michigan Avenue and I get hit by a bus. I go to the hospital and I sue the bus driver, and I get $100,000. That $100,000, at least a portion of it, has to go back to my insurance carrier who paid my medical bills, okay? Because part of the contract with an insurance carrier is that if I get money from a third party to compensate me for my medical bills, I've got to pay at least some of it back to the health insurance carrier. But this is not the case. This is a case that she was injured many, many years ago, and if she has surgery or whatever, it's covered under the insurance policy. But interesting question. There's one more that I saw that I liked here, and it was a caller or texter who said, he hired a rental management company I'm reading between the lines. He must own condo units. He hired a company to manage those units, meaning rent them out, deal with the tenants, collect the rent, and do those types of things. The management company was supposed to get some paperwork from the tenants and didn't do that. And as a result, there was about $1,500 that the homeowners association fined him for, fined the owner. He is saying to me, do I have a right to make the rental management company pay that those fines because it was their fault that he didn't get the paperwork, or does he go and pay those fines and then sue the rental company? Well, the answer is either. I would probably write a letter to the rental management company in writing saying, this was your obligation. This is what you were supposed to do. This is what you didn't do. Please cut the check directly to the Homeowners Association for $1,500. And then I would probably cancel my contract with them because it doesn't sound like they're on the ball and doing their job. If they refuse to do it for some reason, saying it wasn't their fault, then you're probably going to have to go to the Homeowners Association, either try to negotiate those fines down or pay them and then bring a small claim against the rental management company, which for $1,500 is probably a lot of work and a lot of time, and it may or may not be worth the effort. Thank you for all your calls. Thank you for all my guests. I'm going to give out my numbers again at the office, 312-332-7800. And if you want to email me, it's WGN at AskKarenConti.com.